You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 161 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Artistic Sensitivity as a Spiritual Approach to Knowing Life and the World, translated by Rory Bradley. Lecture 4, given in Dornach on February 2, 1915. We have often had the opportunity in our discussions to draw attention to the fact that anyone who really wants to understand life and existence can never actually make the claim that life and existence are somehow simple things. The complexity and multifaceted nature of the world harmony into which the human being is woven must be constantly remembered. More and more we hear people now saying that truth, and by this they usually mean the truth about the highest things, must be quite simple. And people love nothing more than for someone to tell them truth about the highest things in such a way that they actually do not have to learn anything at all, but rather can receive it without any process of learning it out of themselves. Any person, as I have often mentioned, will admit that he cannot understand a clock if he has not learned to understand its interlocked gears and the rest of its mechanism. Only when it comes to the great, magnificent, powerful world creation do people want to gain some understanding without making any sort of effort. Now, all of spiritual science is there, mostly to grant us an understanding, gradually and slowly, of the true sense and meaning of life and existence. Today I would like to add a little something to what we have already observed. In the process, I would like to add to the concepts and ideas that come up often, ideas that we have often taken up together. I would like to start with the fact that from the standpoint of spiritual science, we have often had occasion to say that the external existence in which we live is a Maya, or indeed, in quotes, the Maya, the great deception. I have also emphasized that our worldview within the tradition of Western philosophy cannot be one that understands our surroundings as a deception, in the sense of our surroundings being untrue. The world as such, the world that works upon our senses, and that we grasp with our understanding, is not a Maya. This world is true reality in its inmost being. But the way in which the human being regards it, the way in which it appears to the human being, this is what makes the world into the Maya, into the great deception. And if through our inner soul work we come to find the actual deep foundations of what our senses show us and what our understanding tells us, then we will quickly see the ways in which the external world can be grasped as a deception. For the world appears to us in its true light, in truth, when we know how to complete the picture of it, when we can perceive that it has things that remain hidden in the first moment of observing and considering it. This is what gives human beings our essential nature, worth, and purpose. That the cosmos, the universe, does not treat us like immature children who need to be spoon-fed the truth. It is a given that human beings must work hard to gain the truth by their own effort, the effort of an entire lifetime. The forces of the world greatly depend upon our collaboration in arriving at the truth. They are counting on our freedom, on our dignity. Now, the whole of human life, as it first plays out between birth and death, is a maya, a deception. This human life must be a deception because, when we consider the world only in terms of its physical things and physical conditions, we always leave out the other side of the world and the human experience of this world existence. We leave out the things that human beings experience between death and a new birth. Now, one might certainly say that we can understand human life between birth and death simply by observing and considering it. What use is there to consider the other side, the life between death and a new birth? But already, this is a totally incorrect concept, for the simple reason that the life between birth and death is a reflection of the life between death and a new birth. Everything that we experienced in the life that preceded our current physical life is reflected in the life that we live between birth and death. To understand this reflection, we need to turn our attention toward two things. The first is that we consider certain stages, certain key points of our life between birth and death, and investigate the extent to which these points are in fact reflections of things from the life between death and a new birth. Then we need to bear in mind that the life between death and a new birth is connected much more intensively with the unknown worlds that we speak about in spiritual science, with the conditions that played out before this formation of the earth, on old Saturn, the sun and the moon. These conditions on Saturn, the sun and the moon are much more connected with the life that we live between death and a new birth than with the life that we live between birth and death. We can even say that the life between death and birth is everywhere and in every way influenced by the bygone lives that we know as the preceding planetary lives of Saturn, Sun, and Moon. The things that the Saturn, Sun, and Moon lives affect in our hidden earthly life between death and a new birth is then reflected in the life between birth and death in such a way that the life between birth and death is a kind of mirror image of what occurred between death and a new birth. And the things that occurred between death and a new birth are directly influenced by the things that played out on old Saturn, old Sun, and old Moon. We must consider certain key moments, certain stages of our earthly life, if we want to better understand the process in detail. The first thing that belongs to earthly life is what we refer to as conception, in reference to physical existence. After that follows the embryonic human life. After that comes the birth of the human being, its entrance onto the physical plane. Now, spiritual science reveals a very particular fact about human life. In the whole of the life that we spend in our physical body, we actually have only one condition that is necessarily connected with earthly life, which is to say that there is only one condition that can be explained purely in reference to earthly life, namely conception. Apart from conception, nothing else in human life has anything to do with earthly life directly and exclusively. I would like to really emphasize that word, exclusively. What happens at the moment of conception has nothing to do with Moon, Sun, and Saturn life. The causes of the things that happen in the moment of conception are generated entirely within earthly life. Since exoteric biology and exoteric physical science in general prefer to concern themselves only with earthly life and consider everything that has to do with Moon, Sun, and Saturn life to be utter nonsense, this exoteric science can discover truth, in the physical sense of the word, only about the act of conception. For the same reason, when we read through the works of someone like Ernst Haeckel, we find that the most detailed descriptions are of the processes in the parent organisms that construct the human being, and that there is a constant return to things that are somehow connected with conception. Think about that, and compare it with what exoteric science has to say, and you find that it is confirmed. The physical scientific consideration of these processes within the human being typically go back to the most simple single-celled form. This form of the single-celled organism from which the human being develops, it develops, of course, from the fertilized egg cell, did not exist on old Saturn, old Sun, or old Moon. It is to be found only on Earth. And on Earth, this kind of unification of cells occurs that is highly prized by exoteric physical science. This particular stage of our life is nothing other than the reflection of a real and genuine process that plays out prior to the moment of conception and is connected with human life. We are, of course, dealing with the last period of our life between death and a new birth, but also with the moment still within the spiritual world when we are physically conceived. At that moment, something always happens with us in spiritual life. And conception itself is nothing more or less than a reflection of this process, a maya. The true process plays out in the spiritual world. And what happens in the physical world is a reflection of this, a maya. But what happens in the spiritual world is a process that plays out between the sun and the earth. And it plays out in such a way that the female element experiences the influence of the sun, and the male element experiences the influence of the earth. So the process of conception is the reflection of a collaboration between sun and earth. This is to say that this process, which people so often demote to a realm that is altogether humiliating for humanity, is among the most significant mysteries. It is the reflection of a cosmic world process. It will be interesting to draw our attention to a few details here. As an individual draws near to the moment of entering into the earth once again, he or she forms an imagination in the soul of the parents through whom his re-entry will be made. How the individual is led to these parents is connected with human karma. This is something that bears repeating. But what I want to draw our attention to today is the fact that the person who is moving toward birth already has an interior image of what is physically present on the earth. In particular, the individual has an image of the mother. So the individual who is moving toward birth is primarily looking out toward the mother. Now, the image of the father, and I would ask you to bear this in mind because it is a very significant thing, is there only insofar as the mother has the image of the father within her soul. In other words, the father is seen through the image that the mother carries of the father within her soul. Of course, this is putting it in the most radical terms, shall we say, but it is fundamentally the truth of the matter. You can really talk about these supra-sensory processes only by describing their essence, so that you do not come away with too fixed an imagination of this. I would like to add that, for example, nevertheless, if the soul's spiritual inheritance from the Father's side is to play a very significant role in someone's life, which is to say that certain soul spiritual characteristics had to be passed down from the Father to the person being born, then it is possible that the individual might have a direct image of the Father within him or herself. But the more this unmediated image of the Father can be perceived, the more the image of the Mother fades. The next stage of physical life on earth is the life lived between conception and birth. At the fundamental level, this stage of life, we call it the embryonic stage, is also a reflection of another process that takes place in the spiritual world before the one that I just described. Whereas in physical life, birth follows naturally from conception, the process of which birth is a reflection actually occurs before the sun-earth process that is reflected in conception. This life that people live between conception and birth is already one that cannot be at all explained through reference to the other conditions on the earth, and the desire to give an explanation based on the forces and laws at work on the earth is nothing less than a very, very common bit of nonsense. This is because it is precisely the reflection of a pre-birth process that is fundamentally influenced by the things that remain from the pre-earth moon and the pre-earth sun. It is a process that plays out between the sun and the moon, and in this way is truly a supra-earthly process. The forces that are active there are primarily those at play between the sun and the moon. Exoteric science has a vague awareness of this fact in its consciousness, for it counts the embryonic lifespan in terms of months connected with the moon, and notes that it encompasses 10 cycles of the moon. Understanding it in this way, we see that in the life we live between death and a new birth, we experience a real and genuine influence from the sun and the moon, and that later in our physical life, this process, which is a process of the sun and the moon, is reflected in the time between conception and birth. Please note that this word reflected is not, of course, being used in the physical sense. In the case of a physical reflection, you have the object and the image of it simultaneously. But here the true process is carried out prior to the moment of birth, and the reflection of that process comes at a temporally later point. The reflection, therefore, is the maya of a suprasensory process that occurs before birth. We must now turn our eyes toward the period of time between birth and the next important moment in human life that is often mentioned, the moment when we begin to develop consciousness of the I, the moment we begin to consciously say I. We can call this period true childhood. This period, the first childhood, or perhaps you would rather call it infancy, is again a reflection of a process that happens even earlier in the spiritual life. The real process that is reflected in the period when we begin to babble without connecting this speech with the consciousness of the I is a reflection of a process that plays out prior to birth, one that reaches even farther back into the cosmos. And during this process, we can say that there is a collaboration between the sun and the whole planetary system that belongs to the sun, which is to say the sun and the planets that orbit it, with the exception of the moon. The forces that are at play between the sun and its planets work their way into our life between death and a new birth. And this process that happens long before our birth is reflected in the life we live during the very first years of childhood. From this you can see that reflections of things more removed from the earth than the moon are at play in the life of the child. This has an enormous and deeply significant practical consequence. The consequence is that during this period of the human being's life, we should not disturb its ability to take up or make use of the forces that it has gathered. Just think for a moment about what is actually happening here. Before birth, forces from the cosmos have affected us. Forces that are at play between the sun and its planets. These forces are in the child who has come into the world and stepped into earth life through birth. These forces want to radiate out from the child. These forces are really there within the child. In this sense, every child in its inmost being is an emissary from the heavens, and the forces within want to emerge in the world. We can essentially do nothing more than give these forces the greatest possibility of emerging. Basically, this is the only thing that we have to do during the first period of the child's infancy. We may not disturb the forces that want to emerge from the child. There is something humbling about this knowledge, I would say. Though people usually believe that they can be very significant for a child, the truth is that the most we can do is disturb as little as possible the forces that want to emerge. This is not to say that the person who rears a child is nothing to him or her. This is not true at all. For what emerges from the child, pay close attention to this, is after all a reflection. And the person rearing the child must give a sense of reality to that reflection. This reflection must be given a firm footing to stand on. Our task as nurturers and educators can be described as follows. Say we had an object that was reflected in a mirror here. Then we would have a reflected image. And we would need to bring something to that reflected image that made it firmer inwardly, for it is nothing more than an image. The human being comes into the world, in fact, as a kind of mirror image, and it must acquire a sense of firmness and reality to pair with this reflection. This is what is developed between birth and death. The things that want to emerge from the human being must be disturbed as little as possible. What emerges are the mirror images of the processes that we acquired from the cosmos prior to birth. But through our influence, we must tie the things that emerge as mirror images to reality. And whenever we tie them to a false reality, which is to say, whenever we intend to correct them, those are the times we are prone to disturb or destroy them. Those forces are supra-earthly. Now you can see the extremely significant consequence that comes out of this. Those of us who intend to raise a child are dependent upon the fact that in our own soul in which we live near the child, we have suprasensory imaginations and perceptions. And everything that we bring to the child that is connected solely with material imaginations and perceptions disturbs the child's development. People often ask what they can do to best rear a child. As with so many things, it is not so much a matter of coming up with a few ground rules that we can carry in our vest pockets or purses and use to guide our actions. Instead, we must start with ourselves and make an effort to carry a font of suprasensory imaginations within ourselves, to be filled with sense perceptions that reach up into the suprasensory realm. Such things are far more effective than what we might be able to achieve through external rules of logic and a pedagogy based on reason. A loving heart-mind, Gemüt, that is filled with the suprasensory world and whose perceptions are all deepened by this connection, is thereby in a position during child-rearing to develop a certain kind of cultus, religious devotion, shall we say, and please do not misunderstand this word, one that comes about because we love a being that has been sent to us from the spiritual world, that comes about through a spiritualization of the love for a child, that comes about because we are filled with the feeling that by reaching out our hand to the child, we are extending something to it. But we must also be a representative to the child of the forces that are not to be found on earth, but rather in the suprasensory realm. Everything that one might elaborate about various pedagogical principles will be altogether fruitless so long as science treads on materialistic paths. Only what comes out of spiritual science will be productive for the true rearing of the child. And the most important thing is the work that we do on ourselves. Although we are able to accomplish a lot in the external material world by what we do, as a nurturer or educator, we accomplish much more through who we are. I would ask you to take note of that. We can take that as a motto for a good pedagogy. In the external world, you achieve things by what you do. As a nurturer or educator, you achieve things by who you are. Then comes the period in which the children achieve boyhood or girlhood, the period in which they are still being nurtured and educated, but in a different way than during infancy. This is the next stage, the next step that we will consider. It encompasses everything between the time when a human being first begins to consciously say, I, to the time when we can release the child out of the actual nurturing or education period, the time when the human being steps out freely into life, the moment in which the child is surrendered to the turbulence of life as either a well-bred or ill-bred person. This too is a reflection, an external maya, namely, a reflection of processes that preceded it. The true realities, as before, lie between death and a new birth. And in this process works the whole planetary system from the Sun to Saturn, or, if you follow more recent astronomy, to Neptune. The whole planetary system is at work here with the stars, and the forces that play out between the stars and the planetary system are those that are active in us during the period of time when we are nurtured and educated. The processes that play out only on the earth tell us so little about human reality. We can truly understand the stages of human development during the period of nurturing and education only if we are clear about the fact that during those times, forces are at play in a person that are part of life in the broader sense. That broader life exists not only on Earth, not only in the planetary system, but also outside of the planet's orbits, working in harmony with all of the stars and cosmos. If we have before us a child who can already say I, making the child a being that in a certain sense we can speak of as a human, we must be clear about the fact that living in that child there is a reflection of something that is active, not only beyond the realm of the Earth, but also beyond the realm of the whole planetary system. For the later period of nurturing and development, what was said earlier is even more the case. That is the assertion that we will be able to arrive at a good pedagogy only when it comes out of spiritual science, when the teacher knows that beyond the planetary system lies a world that then unfolds within the human being. We arrive at good pedagogy when this knowledge is not only theoretical, but also felt and perceived completely, when the teacher has actually experienced the truth of this world beyond the planetary system for him or herself. Even when a teacher like this is somewhat fumbling and awkward, it can often be better than the well-articulated pedagogical principles of a materialistic teacher. For the things we fumble with, our foolishness, these things improve over the course of our lives. But the things that happen in the world because of who we are cannot be rectified in the same way. Among the things that spiritual science should metamorphose or transform, we should hope that it also allows more and more people to see that those who intend to be teachers or nurturers, which is to say, anyone who intends to be a parent, need to see that they will become better teachers and nurturers by taking up spiritual imaginations that they collect in their own souls. If you want to become a good teacher, most of the work that you need to do is work on yourself. And before stepping into the classroom, it should be more important to the teacher to live fully into the material with his or her whole heart, rather than to acquire the best possible pedagogical guidelines about how to do one thing or another. And after the teacher has fully taken to the material and given birth to it inwardly through love, then he or she can fumble through the lesson, although I am not recommending it, and still teach more effectively than someone who steps into the classroom with a mind constricted by many guidelines and principles, locked up as though in a Spanish boot, knowing how to do everything in the most proper way. We know that for the moment, things are proceeding in the world in very contradictory directions. Those who are to become teachers now are tested primarily on what they know, on how much content they have taken in. We might almost say that they are tested on things that they could find in books, and it might just be better to collect a library instead. They are tested primarily on things that you could find any time in a library, if you know anything about research. When it comes to testing teachers, we should not be testing things that the teacher could easily find in the moment it might be needed. Less value should be placed on knowledge. On the other hand, every teacher must be extremely accomplished in the ability to connect his or her sensibility with the knowledge, the feeling that can be acquired for the development of the whole universe. The abilities of a teacher should be measured by the feeling that he or she has for human and world evolution. Then, those who simply knew the most would fail their exams, and those who were good people in the spiritual sense would pass with flying colors. Eventually, this will come to pass. It is what we must be moving toward, that someone who is not a good person, whose soul is not attuned to spiritual life, will someday fail the exam to become a teacher, no matter how much he might know. Even if he had all of the knowledge that people need to have now in just his little finger. It will be here that the door will open to placing less value on mere knowledge and more value on the whole unfolding and development of the soul. Let me stress one more time that our worth is not measured by what we accomplish in the external material world, by what we do. As educators and nurturers, our worth is measured far more by who we are. Now let us turn our attention to a full consideration of everything related to the real process that is reflected in the moment of conception. All of that belongs to Earth. But insofar as it is a process that plays out prior to birth, it also belongs to the collaboration of sun and earth. It is simply completed within the earth aura. Within the earth aura, a significant spiritual process plays out prior to human conception, a process which is then reflected in the conception itself. What then plays out between this moment and the moment that is reflected in birth is in reality a pre-birth collaboration between sun and moon. This collaboration is essentially a repeat of processes that once played out on old moon. So, during the embryonic stage of human life, the reflection of a real process plays out, and this real process plays out before birth and is a repetition of processes that played out on old moon. In the same way, the processes reflected in the period between the end of infancy, the moment when a person consciously says I, and birth, plays out as a repetition of the conditions on old sun. What plays out before that, which is then reflected in the final stage of education and nurturing, is a repetition of processes from old Saturn. And then, when we step out of nurturing and education into the world as well-bred or ill-bred persons, what processes are reflected then? At that point, processes from before the period of old Saturn are reflected. Processes that do not belong to the visible world and never have. Ones that have no correlative to the external visible stars. The correlatives of the things that we experience up until the end of the period of our education can still, in a certain sense, be seen. The most distant stars that are nevertheless still visible have a relationship to these processes. But what we experience beyond that, the things that can still take form within us, belong entirely to the invisible world. When we truly reach the end of our education, we are released from the visible world altogether. And so, naturally, by this point, it becomes important that we enrich our souls, or that we have already enriched them prior to this moment, with truths of the supersensory world. For this is the only means by which we will find our way through life. Otherwise, we are nothing more than puppets, led by forces that we are not actually meant to be led by. the human being who has no imagination of the supra-sensory world, following the reflection of old Saturn, during the end of his or her education and release into the world, is not in his or her natural element, but rather is taken along by invisible forces, just as a harlequin or marionette is dragged along by the forces and the threads that tug at it. To become a human being means to take up the things that spiritual science has to give. It does not mean becoming a puppet or marionette of the sensory world. It means getting to a place of freedom, which is the element in which the human being should move and live throughout life. Freedom can be understood only through such concepts, which do not come from the sensory world. For nothing that we take from the sensory world can make us free. This is what I had in mind when I wrote my title, Philosophy of Freedom, Readers Aside, also known as Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, also known as Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, end of Readers Aside, in which I stressed that the foundation of ethics and morality must be identified through the moral imagination, which in a sense can happen even without the perceptions of spiritual science. In other words, they must be founded on a foundation of moral imagination, even though morality should not be understood merely as a fantasy. Ethics and morality must be discovered through the moral imagination, through something that cannot be taken from the sensory world. The whole chapter that I wrote about the moral imagination is an affirmation of the fact that insofar as we live in freedom, we must understand ourselves to be in connection with something that is beyond the sensory world. This is a picture, built, but what must arise freely within this picture, its essence, lies beyond the visible stars. It is not drawn from the sensory world, but summoned by inner creative work. This is what was meant by the chapter on moral imagination. This consideration was intended, once again, to demonstrate the complexity of the network of connections in which we find ourselves in life. Just as life before birth is a preparation for its later reflection, so too is the reflection that plays out between birth and death a preparation for the spiritual life that will follow between death and a new birth. The more that we can carry out this life into the life between death and a new birth, the richer our development during that life can be. But even the concepts that we must adopt for that life, the truths of the life between death and a new birth, are altogether different from the ones we must adopt if we hope to understand this earthly Maya. Several of these concepts that we must adopt can be found in the lecture cycle from 1914, titled The Inner Nature of Man and Our Life Between Death and Rebirth. There you will find a description of how we must adopt new concepts in order to understand the other side of human life, which runs between death and a new birth. Sometimes it is truly difficult to really work out the concepts and ideas that are needed for this altogether different form of life. And when you read through it, you will notice in a lecture cycle like that one that it is quite a difficult task to come up with ways of really expressing and describing these wholly different life conditions. At this time, when we are experiencing the death of several dear members of our anthroposophic life, I would like to draw our attention to one thing in particular. In the life between death and a new birth, the moment of death plays a different role than the moment of birth does in the lives we are currently living, the life between birth and death. The moment of birth is a moment that, in the normal conditions of our human lives, we do not remember. Normally, a person does not remember the moment of birth. But for the life between death and a new birth, the moment of death leaves behind a very deep impression. It is the moment that is remembered above all others, the moment that is always there, in some sense, although in a different form than the one that it appears to have from this side of life. From this side of life, death appears as a kind of dissolution, as something it is easy to be afraid of. From the other side of life, death appears as the most brilliant beginning of the spiritual experience, as something that radiates outward like a beam of sunlight over the whole ensuing life between death and a new birth, something that warms the soul through and through with joy during that life between death and a new birth, something that is looked back on again and again with the greatest fondness. That is the moment of death. If we want to describe it with earthly expressions, we could say that the most joyous and delightful thing in the life between death and a new birth is the moment of death as seen from the other side of life. If we have the sense, from a materialistic worldview, that the human loses consciousness in death, if we are not able to arrive at a proper imagination of the continuation of consciousness, parenthesis, I am speaking about this today in particular, because the impetus and occasion for this work is an attempt at coexistence with the dear friends who have recently passed into death, close parenthesis, if it is so difficult for us to imagine that consciousness extends beyond death, and we continue to believe that consciousness fades, parenthesis, for it does seem that consciousness must fade after death, close parenthesis, if these things are true, then we must learn to be clear about the fact that they are simply not true, for consciousness is something brilliantly bright. And it is only because we are not yet used to living in the overwhelming clarity of this consciousness that we first enter a state akin to sleeping immediately following the moment of death. This sleeping state is, however, the opposite of the sleeping state that we experience in normal life. In normal life, we sleep because consciousness has been suppressed. After death, we are unconscious in a certain sense, because the consciousness we experience is too strong, too powerful, because we are living entirely within consciousness. And what we need in the first few days after death is to gradually live into this overwhelming state of consciousness. We must learn to orient ourselves within it. If we succeed in orienting ourselves enough within it, rising up from the whole collection of world thoughts, we begin to have the feeling of distinguishing our past self. Quote, "That was you," close quote. In that moment, when we begin to differentiate our past earth life from the whole collection of world thought, we experience within that fullness of consciousness the moment when we wake up, so to speak. We might perhaps be awakened by an experience that played a particularly significant part in our life on earth, an experience that then also plays a role in our experiences after that earth life. So it is a process of getting used to suprasensory consciousness, to the consciousness that is not built upon the foundation and support of the physical world, but that works in and upon itself. This is what we call, quote, waking up, close quote, after death. We might say that this waking up happens through a process of fumbling with the will and eventually bringing it into balance. As you know, and as you can see in the lecture cycle that I mentioned, the will, especially, can develop after death. In those earlier lectures, I spoke about the feeling will and about willed feelings. When this willed feeling life probes its way into the suprasensory world and begins to fumble about there, the moment of waking up occurs. These are things that, if the opportunity presents itself, we will speak about again at another time. The end of Lecture 4.